I'm very pleased to welcome back to the Catalpa Escape podcast series, Margot O'Byrne. Welcome back, Margot. We're here in chapter four. The story's starting to rocket along.
Oh, it's definitely getting moving, isn't it, Michael?
Well, just to remind our listeners, in episode three, we had John T. Richardson, the shipping agent, and his son-in-law, Captain George Anthony, supervising the purchase of the Catalpa in Boston. The Catalpa's, front and centre. And Richardson, very kindly, even though he wasn't a Fenian or an Irishman, but a Quaker from the east coast of the US, was prepared to advance Clan na Gael, the Irish Association, $4,000 to put a down payment on the Catalpa before they lost her. But it had to be paid back in 30 days. And that's where we sort of were starting to wrap things up. And of course, Reynolds, you indicated, was prepared to secure his property to ensure the purchase. But the Clan na Gael Rescue Committee also had to go out and find the funds, you were saying. So what happens then? Things start to move. You need the money, you need the boat, you need the crew, you need to fit it out. And I imagine everybody who gets to hear about this wants to be on the expedition, Margot, all the good Irishmen.
Oh, a cast of thousands, Michael.
Well, tell us first about the money. We always are interested in money. Show us the money. Follow the money is the usual call. Did they get it all?
I mean, you and I have both been on committees. We've both tried to raise money for various causes, and I'm sure many of your listeners have as well. So trying to get a pledge of the money and realizing the money are often there's a bit of a lag time. So I think it was, I mean, we've learned before that Richardson was an extremely savvy businessman, and yet he clearly was so swayed by the story and the passion of, freeing these men from Fremantle prison that he was prepared to put up the money. Now, I'm sure as a savvy businessman, he wouldn't have done that terribly often, or he wouldn't have been considered a good businessman after all. So, and I can imagine only, what James Reynolds's wife said to him when he went home and said, "Well, I'm going to mortgage the house, dear. It's time to put my money where my belief is." So they're kind of lines in a podcast, but we have to understand what's underneath it all too. So that meant that the ship could be purchased. They once Reynolds signed over the money to the promissory note to Reynolds to Richardson, and once the ship was purchased, then it had to be it, because Reynolds had allocated it. He was actually the official owner, so he's one of the rescue committee, but he's the official owner. So in Clan na Gael circles, then he was always known then and after as Catalpa Jim.
I imagine to accord Catalpa Jimmy's proper role in Fenian and Western Australian history, we mention all these other names, but he obviously plays a significant role in all of this. He's got the wherewithal. He's on the committee. He puts up the dough. He mortgages his house. Yes, his wife might have had a few things to say to him, but I mean, an important guy, a businessman in Connecticut, running a foundry.
That's correct. Yes, he was. So we're and it's these people that we find scattered around the story who don't necessarily get the kudos in the Great Catalpa Escape, but they're very many of them are important people just at that moment, just at that time, who provide exactly the link that's needed. And Reynolds was certainly one of those. So then they decided that it was better to, they needed to refurbish and get the boat ready, of course, for this great sea journey and undertake the repairs that were needed. So rather than do it in Boston, where they were, might have aroused suspicion of, British spies or, I'm sure people were keeping a close eye on people like John Boyle O'Reilly forever in Boston. And so they decided to move it to New Bedford because Richardson and Anthony knew the crews there. And once again, another person who steps in is Henry Hathaway. And he said, "Look, I will supervise all of the repairs, that take place, and I don't need any fee for it. I'll do it
Doesn't
for
need
you.
it, doesn't need any fee. This
No.
once again seems to me to show the commitment to the cause of all these people, even people who don't need to have a commitment to the cause.
That's right. That's right. Which is pretty incredible, isn't it? And remember that Hathaway had been on the Gazelle. He'd had 18 years actually at sea as a whaler. So his assistance was invaluable because he could go through item by item and say, "No, you won't need that. That'll be okay. We'll leave that behind. And here's what you can put on board." So
Just staying with him for a minute, Hathaway. I mean, you say he wasn't charging for doing this. If you're drawn up in the committee, how much is it going to cost us to do the repairs? How much money do we have to raise? You can strike a line through that provisional item. We need someone to oversee it, and we're going to have to pay them X dollars an hour. Hathaway's doing it for nothing.
he is. And remember, he was at this stage, he was probably a bit older. He was the head of the night police in New Bedford. So he had a position there. But obviously, during the day, he went off and supervised the reprovisioning of the Catalpa. So not only was he putting in his time, but this was his, I'm sure it became his whole life for that period of time.
Do we have some idea of what sort of repairs, what sort of equipment, what sort of stuff had to be attached to, put on, improve the Catalpa before it went off on this expedition?
Yeah, we do, Michael. So things like new sails, like it was a three-masted sailing ship, so there's a lot of sails that are needed. A new anchor, a chronometer. They had to have provisions in all the food and equipment that they would need for this time. They needed water and oil casks. Remember, they were going to do some whaling at the start of this in order to pay for offset some of the payments for this ship. So therefore they needed harpoons and lances. They needed first aid chests. And of course they needed wine and rum in quantities enough for 2 years at sea.
Of course. I
Got to keep the crew happy.
wonder what was wrong with the anchor. I suppose, though, if you're going off into uncharted waters, in a sense, you have to know you've got an anchor that'll be big enough to do the job.
I guess so. I think it's probably, you couldn't go with a half rusty anchor, really, could you?
The Fremantle Dockers. Now, that enabled, I suppose, people like Devoy and Catalpa Jim to start to add up what this is actually going to cost. They've already got some, as you said, prior commitments from the Clan na Gael people, but you have a much better idea now. Does Devoy become the main guy to round up the funds and drag them in?
He does. And I think this Devoy was like, Devoy's a very decisive man. He just likes to do things. It seems that the people that he chooses to work with him, he's very clear. He likes them straight away. So it must have been just such a pain for him to go back and to beg Clan na Gael all the time to, here's another bill. Here's, can we have some more funds? And, the grumbling members, oh, I don't know why we're paying that much, all that sort of thing. And one of the largest expenses was for the resheathing of the ship's keel. Now, all of the ships that came out of New Bedford, all of the whalers, were all had copper keels. That
Why?
was it.
Must
It was
make
to
them very
prevent.
heavy.
Well, it seems like it was heavy. I'm not sure how thick the copper was, but it was to prevent sea worms from eating into the timbers. And apparently, later on, Anthony meets another ship at sea and knows that it's a New Bedford whaler because of the copper keel. So it was quite a mark of distinction for ships from that part of the world. So that was, of course, a very significant expense. And in the end, Richardson wrote to Reynolds and said, "Look, you've got a really good ship. It's going to cost more than we first anticipated." Probably in the region of $17,000 was the final cost
Wow.
of fitting out the whole thing. But he said, "Look, this ship, you'll be able to realise this money later when she comes back from this journey, and you'll be able to sell her. So at least he had some faith in the journey as well.
At this point, where are we in 1875? And when were they thinking they were going to get this ship out of New Bedford and on her way to Frio?
Okay, well, this was they purchased the ship in March, and they set a date to sail. They imagined that they would be totally all the repairs done, provisioned, ready, crew chosen, and ready to go in the last week of April, 1875.
So we're coming into the North American spring summer period at that stage. There must have been a lot of chatter and indeed excitement around the Irish community. How far flung is the Irish community in the US at that point?
Oh, it's pretty much all over the United States. So there's obviously a big concentration in New York and even in New Bedford. Remember we said that Richardson knew about the Irish cause because of the people working in the textile industry there. Of course, Chicago has always had a big Irish community, and then with the discovery of gold in California in the late 1840s, a lot of people from every nationality, of course, made their way to the goldfield.
Including lots. So San Fran would have had a few Irish. I imagine Davoy would be tapping the Irishmen wherever he could find them, particularly if they've just discovered gold.
Yeah. Well, they were the rich community. So then, of course, as soon as they realised, well, the Catalpa's sailing in the end of April, we've got to get a crew. You know, we've got to. We need a crew, and we need to put the Irish were very concerned that at least one of their of the Clan na Gael men should go on board. First of all, it would be another person that Captain Anthony could confide in, because remember he wasn't telling anyone at all about this story. So if he needed to confide in someone, there's one other person on board, and also that it protected their interests. I mean, they've put all their money in the hands of these two Quakers, hoping that they will, you know, be true to their word and actually go and fetch the Irish prisoners here.
So at that time, and we've sort of touched on this before, you're in New Bedford, a whaling port. If you're trying to put the Catalpa out to sea and not get anybody wondering, is this just on some strange mission because of who's on board? What should the standard whaling crew have looked like?
Okay, well, a bit like we see now coming into Fremantle that the whaling crews are quite often, you know, of a particular group of people who are the common seafaring people that will always take these jobs. So first of all, they've got to be skilled. They have to be to work on a whaling boat. You also have to be very strong because you've got to row. You know, you're a tough man. But also, they tended to come. Most of the whaling crews came, they were Malays, Malay people who had come to the Azores and to the Cape Verde Islands as part of that interchange of maritime trade and so on. So you had quite a large population there. I think that they weren't as well paid. To try and get North Americans to go on a whaling crew, you'd have to probably pay them more than you would be able to afford to, which is probably been the history of seafaring all along. But and also Anthony needed to choose what were regular whaling crews. He didn't need to draw any attention whatsoever to the fact that this was more than a whaling venture.
You can just imagine it, can't you? Suddenly you're out at sea, somebody comes past, and there are always these Irishmen who have been profiting. They've already knocked off half the rum and the wine that we'd provisioned for 2 years, and they're all singing Irish
Playing music on the
and jigging around. I mean, you
deck.
couldn't allow that to happen. So how many Irishmen actually made it onto the Catalpa?
Well, Anthony was very clear about this. He said there was only to be one Irishman on board, and that he would only take an Irishman if that man could be either the ship's carpenter or the ship's steward. So someone who had a background in like provisioning and cooking and ordering foods and so on, or otherwise someone who could act as the carpenter and do any repairs. And Devoy, he said, okay, fine, I know the man. There's a fellow called Dennis Duggan. He was a 30-year-old who was born originally in Dublin and had fought in the Irish cause, in the Fenian Rising. He was a coach builder by trade, so therefore he could turn his hand to being a carpenter on a ship. And he'd been a friend with Devoy since they were boys.
Ah,
So
nice touch.
Devoy knew, here's your man, I can trust him, he'll be there in the end.
Well, we've mentioned in the past the young lawyer who was, in a sense, the third man on the committee from the beginning, Gough, John Gough. Does he stay in the picture?
Oh, he stays in the picture, let me tell you. One of the things that, and he seems to be quite a man who wants his own way. Now, you'd be unfamiliar with this, Michael, wouldn't you? From lawyers. So Gough said, okay, I'll accept Duggan. He's a good man, but I want my man to go as well. And his man was Tom Brennan. And Tom Brennan, he said, you can take Duggan, providing you take Brennan. But Brennan had proved his courage as a, in the Fenian cause, but Devoy felt that Brennan was impetuous, he was hot-tempered, he was inclined to fly off at the handle, and he wouldn't be a good man to have in a crisis situation. And apart from that, what were his skills that he was bringing to the Catalpa?
Well,
So then.
how do you resolve something like that? You can pray to the good Lord and try and look for divine inspiration, or you can possibly go to third parties.
Third party, well, that's what I don't know that we've perhaps Devoy was a devout, Catholic man, but we haven't heard much evidence of that. He seems to be a very hard-headed, practical, results-driven kind of man. And so he went straight to Reynolds, the official owner,
I went to
and
Reynolds. Yes.
went to Reynolds and he said, it's only Duggan. Only Duggan is going on board. And then Anthony, Captain Anthony and Hathaway and Richardson back in New Bedford heard about this, and they said, because I suspect Devoy wrote to them as well, and they sent Reynolds an urgent note saying, under no circumstances could they take any more than one Irishman without tipping off the authorities.
Well, it makes me wonder whether, to use an Irish expression, Margot, John Gough lost his paddy.
Well, I think he certainly seemed to be a bit of an egotistical man who wanted his own way, right? Whereas most other people in this story seem to be able to see the cause as the greater good rather than what their own particular interest was. And customs officials were already questioning the Catalpa about the details of their whaling voyage, so Anthony and Richardson and Hathaway were very clear that they wanted to keep it all very, very, very normal. And Duggan was the man that they both chose.
So we're getting close to the end of April. They're provisioning, doing the repairs, choosing the crew. They've got what looks like pretty much a standard crew, so pretty much like a crew of a container ship arriving in Perth, Fremantle this morning. You know, it's
Correct.
a Filipino, Bangladeshian crew, maybe some others from the subcontinent. All of the factors you've mentioned previously come into play. They've got someone. Namely Duggan, who can help Anthony out and be a rapporteur, I suppose, for the people back home if it's needed. And they're ready to go. Now, there must have been a moment of complete excitement. I mean, think of the Titanic leaving for Ireland, in fact, don't they? But don't finish up having a very good maiden voyage. This mob are well in advance of the Titanic, but do they? I mean, who gives the final instructions here? Who's telling them what to do? Who's telling them where they have to go?
Okay, so Captain Anthony and sends a message through to Devoy saying we'll be sailing, giving the date that they anticipate sailing, and suggests that they come to New Bedford. Of course, they wouldn't have needed a second invitation, as you say, the excitement level would have been pretty high. But when Devoy and Reynolds get on the train and off they go to New Bedford. And when they get there, There's a telegram from Gough.
Gough.
Gough, the lawyer.
Oh, I wonder what this could possibly say.
He says that Brennan is taking the train and he to the seaport. He will be there and he is to be taken on board.
Oh my goodness. He who pays the piper plays the song very often.
Exactly. So on the morning of the 29th of April, the rescue committee gathered on the dock to farewell the Catalpa. Gough, of course, rushed at the last minute to the dock to argue with Captain Anthony that Brennan had to be part of the crew. Now, Devoy was absolutely seething at this stage, but then he stood back and saw once again the calibre of Captain Anthony.
Oh.
Anthony said Duggan was the ship's carpenter, he had a place on the ship, and Brennan had no papers, and under no circumstances would he allow him on board. If there was a sudden change in the ship's roster, both the customs and the US Navy would come down on the Catalpa. So this convinced Devoy that he was that even more certain that Anthony was the right man for the job. Cool under pressure, able to stand up to the committee, whoever, the owners, but he was the captain and he was taking charge.
Do we have any
So once
sense of how Gough responded to all of that? Did he sort of throw his toys out of the bassinet?
Well, I think he was about to until, of course, Henry Hathaway, our wonderful man who can seems to be able to solve any problem, he suggested that inevitably, whaling ships tended to lose one a crew or two through sickness, or maybe someone dies, or there's desertion in one of the ports. So he said to Brennan, he said to Gough, maybe Brennan could take one of the mailing ships to the Azores and meet up there with the Catalpa, and then Captain Anthony could take him on board at his own discretion, whether he wanted to or not.
How brilliant. So, like the Fremantle Dockers who go into each football match with an emergency, Tom Brennan becomes the emergency.
Well, only if he can get himself to the Azores, which I guess Gough had to pay for.
Well, still sticking together the Fenian cause was more important than all these individual challenges. So, I mean, what are we talking about? What's the length of this voyage? I mean, how long does it take to get to the Azores anyway?
Well, they would go. It would take. You could get to the Azores on a steamer quite, within a week. But in terms of the sailing there, they expected to go leave New Bedford. Remember, they had to keep the crew happy. The crew get a part of their pay is from the amount of sperm whales that they catch and the oil that they manage to be able to ship back.
Well, forgive
So.
me, but you wouldn't be catching many whales around the Azores, would you? Where do you go to catch them?
In the North Atlantic, they were still whaling at that stage.
Right.
So you would there'd be a shipping pathway around there, and of course, Captain Anthony wouldn't have wanted to catch too many whales there because he would have been suggesting to the crew that it was even more important that they sail south in order to look for further whales. So you would catch a few, keep the crew happy. Put into to Fayal in the Azores, ship home any oil that you've already managed to take, along with messages that you might take, and then after that, Anthony was instructed that once they'd done that they were to head for the west coast of Australia, and to arrive in the port of Bunbury in early 1876. So really, about 9 months on from when they left New Bedford. They're expecting to land in Bunbury.
Well,
And
and
one.
we know was the place more or less from which J.B. O'Reilly had been picked up and spirited out of Australia, out of Western Australia, out of the penal colony, and taken off eventually to New York. So, does the Catalpa sail on time?
It's delayed a couple of days because Captain Anthony's mother takes ill, and so they wait another day while Anthony is with it by her side. But finally, on the morning of the 29th of April, 1875, the Catalpa sails out of New Bedford. They fly on one mast, the topaz red and white flag with the letters JTR, That's Richardson's house flag. On the other mask is a large white pendant with a blue letter C for Catalpa. And on the rear of the ship, she flew, of course, the Stars and Stripes.
Oh, what a lovely scene. You can see it all. We should try and create an image of that on ChatGPT or the like.
Perhaps we could get another Catalpa next year for the anniversary, Michael, and sail her into Rockingham.
That's a great idea.
Bunbury.
Oh, it can be done. Well, I mean, like they know about Bunbury. They know the priest's probably still down there, although they'll be keeping a close watch on him. You need someone lurking around in the local community, don't you? Organising everything, presumably.
You
Have
do.
they thought about that?
Oh, they have thought about that. Well, of course, then once the ship is sailing, then you really need to get the operatives, the Australian operatives, to select them. So, Devoy knew that unless Clandegarle could place the right person on the ground in Australia, that Anthony would never succeed in extracting the Fenians from the Fremantle prison. There had to be a plot part of it here too, as well. And the traits that he felt he needed from these kind of men were nerve, cunning, and a pronounced knack for deception. Because these people would literally be working in the shadows of the establishment.
Wow,
So
so you need good, tricky, active spies, people who are embedded in the local community who can organise it all.
but remember, Irish people in the local community would have been absolutely scrutinised by the colonial authorities here. So you had to bring in some people from the United States who, or somewhere, who could actually act out some sort of something that's going on. So what Devoy did, he said, oh, okay. So he went and found this man, John J. Breslin.
Why didn't he do it himself? He'd be.
Well, he wanted to do it himself, but I mean, he would have put his hand up and come straight away. But Devoy was absolutely, totally well known as the leader of the Fenians. If he had arrived here in Fremantle, I think every policeman, every water policeman, every detective would have known about Devoy, and he'd been
Ported
spent
on the.
5 years
Yeah,
in
he was
British
ported
prisons.
on
They
the
knew
next
him.
ship out of Fremantle, I imagine.
Well,
So.
he'd be
He
in the
suggests.
establishment himself.
So he, yes. So he suggests John J. Breslin, JJ.
Yes, indeed. So Breslin was quite renowned in Irish circles. He was considered the bona fide Fenian hero, in fact, because he had been the person who, in Dublin, after the Fenian Rising, had managed to smuggle the Fenian leader, James Stevens, out of Richmond Prison. And Stevens escaped when others came here to Fremantle. Stevens was actually went to France. So, and that was on account of John Breslin. John Breslin had been the superintendent of the prison hospital. And what he'd done at the time of Stevens' imprisonment is he'd made a substitute key. And one night, the man who was working with him was actually Duggan, who was our carpenter on the Catalpa. So Duggan and Breslin had marched into the prison and opened the door and let Stevens out. And then we had a man with a boat waiting, and that was John Flood, who was also imprisoned here in Fremantle. He was the editor of the Wild Goose newspaper. So another newspaper editor, Michael.
Well, these are really, really interesting people, and I'm getting the feeling about JJ Breslin that he probably had a whole lot of charm about him as well. Do we know anything about him? Was he a big man, a dwarf, or is he?
No, he was a tall man. He was 5 foot 10 inches tall. He was 38 years old, so he was full of the age at that stage when you would have been successful in whatever it was you were doing. The description of him says that he was splendidly built, with light brown hair, a flowing beard, and blue-grey eyes of singular clearness and brightness.
Oh, wow. Sounds like an Irishman.
He was well. He was born in County in Drogheda in County Meath. He was actually born in the same place as O'Reilly,
Ah,
so
where
there
the
may be
finger is
something in the
all
water there.
something down the south, isn't there, and roundabout. But so does Breslin agree to take the job on?
Okay, so Devoy goes down to meet up with Breslin. Breslin had come from after the escape, after he'd orchestrated this escape of Stevens. He knew that he had to get out of Dublin straight away, so he'd taken a ship to the US. He was never arrested and never charged, and he operated in Boston for a number of years, and then just as a rescue committee was forming, he moved to New York. So he wasn't yet very well known in the New York Irish circles. So again, his disappearance out of that community wouldn't have been noticed at all. So Breslin went in and explained every detail about the escape and what it was that he wanted. And sorry, Devoy explained all of this, and Breslin listened intently and immediately, without hesitation, said, "Yes, I'll do it."
Well, he
So,
didn't get briefed. I mean, he hasn't been to Western Australia. He knows about the exploits of O'Reilly. He's aware of how the American whalers got him out. He would assume, I take it, that yes, as you say, that anybody a little bit odd, particularly if they were a well-known Fenian, turned up, the authorities here would think something was probably afoot. So he gets briefed. I mean, he must think he can carry the job off, Margot.
he sounds like exactly the kind of man who could carry the job off, Michael. And he sounds like the sort of person who would, a bit like Anthony, someone who likes a challenge, is quite strong-minded, quite determined. Yes, I'm going to go off and do it. And but he'd read the letters that Hogan and Wilson had sent to John Devoy, begging for him to get them out of the prison here in Fremantle, to get them out of the living tomb, as they called it. Breslin was smart enough to realize that the authorities, since O'Reilly's escape, would be watching every American whaler that came in to any port in Western Australia. But if he believed that if Hogan and Wilson felt that they could be escaped by sea, then it was worth giving it a try.
So
And
is Breslin going to do this on his own?
no, well, one of the things that remember we said earlier that a lot of the money for Clan na Gael came from California, because everyone, that's where the money was, that's where the wealth of mining, gold mining was. So they had written to Devoy and said, "Look, we want you to take one of our men as well." And Devoy said to him, "Sure, we can do that." And he said to Breslin, "What I'd like you to do is to go to California and meet up with the man that they have chosen over there."
Who
And
is that?
Breslin said, "If I don't like him, I am not taking him. If I can't work with him, I'm not taking him."
So who was he?
He was a man called Thomas Desmond. So Tom Desmond had been born in Cobh in County Cork, and he'd fought in the Fenian movement. And then he'd left. He wasn't arrested in Ireland, but he'd left for the United States, and he had joined the Union Army
No.
and fought in the Civil War. So he was quite a well-known man. He was actually the deputy sheriff of San Francisco at
Oh,
this
for goodness
time.
sake. Amazing. So, did anybody else speak up for Desmond?
Yes, there was a man called John Talbot. Now, Talbot was the money man over in California, and he said, "Desmond, I totally stand by Desmond. He's a strong, decisive man, and he's proved himself under fire, and he'll be there." Now, fortunately, when Breslin left, locked up his flat, took the train to Chicago, and on a further train out to California. And he went to Talbot's home in Sacramento and met up with Desmond. And the very first moment that he met him, he liked him. And I think,
Oh, The only trouble with this story, as others have pointed out over time, is that we've got all these wonderful male actors. We need some stunning woman to enter into the picture, Margot. Does it ever happen?
Oh, I'm sure there are many, there's a lot of the nature of this is that it is told, it's a man escape, men helping other men escape. And there wouldn't have been any women on whaling crews in those days, I can tell you, Michael, unless they pretended to be dressed, cross-dressed and pretended to be a man. But certainly, I mean, the character of Emma Anthony, Captain Anthony's wife,
You're quite right. She must.
married 1 year,
Yeah.
3-month-old baby, and saying, Anthony said that his wife couldn't come to the ship side to see the Catalpa off because he didn't know that he could manage it if she was there.
Oh,
So,
well, that'll be a real tear-jerking moment in the movie. So,
yeah.
the two boys, though, in a sense, fall in love in Sacramento.
Bit of
Breslin,
a
a bit of a
bromance.
bromance, that's the right word, and Desmond. And I assume Desmond has to sort of adopt some sort of persona for the job.
Well, this is when a lot of this detail was worked out. Some of it had been worked out with Devoy, but Breslin and Desmond sat down together. So, and this was their plan. So Breslin was the more urbane, polished person. So he would travel to Australia under the alias of Mr. James Collins. He'd be a wealthy American businessman and a speculator looking for gold mining deals, agricultural deals, forestry deals, that kind of thing in Western Australia. And Desmond was a bit rougher in speech and appearance. And he had once been a carriage maker. So he would come as Tom Johnson, and then he would find work in that in carriage making trade here in Fremantle or in Perth.
So they
And
arrived
from
not
the
knowing each other. They would just turn
so
up.
yeah, from the they decided that from the moment they boarded the ship to Australia, they'd pretend that they'd never met each other, and they'd just give each other a passing nod if they saw each other on the ship. So Breslin then travelled to Los Angeles to meet up with John Keneally. Now, Keneally had been one of the Hougoumont Fenians who'd been in prison here in Fremantle, and
Oh.
Keneally was a great organiser. He's actually Tom, he's a relative of the writer, Australian writer, Tom
Tom
Keneally.
Keneally.
Yeah. But so John Keneally was definitely, he when the Fenians from were pardoned in 1869 here in Fremantle, it was Keneally who went to the east coast of Australia, got the money together, came back, got passages organized for everyone. So he was a very business, like getting things done kind of person. And he sat down with Breslin and Desmond and told them all about the establishment, about the coast north and south of Fremantle. And importantly, he gave them the names of local people who had Fenian leanings. Now,
Well,
today that'd be you and me here in Fremantle, Michael,
oh,
but
it'd have to be on my Mannar Irish side and you on your O'Byrne side, but certainly we'd be trying to help out where we could. So what are the next things that happen?
so on the 10th of December, sorry, 10th of September 1875, Breslin and Desmond then go to San Francisco, ready to board a ship there to come to Fremantle. Sorry, to come to Sydney in order to get to Fremantle. And they were exhilarated to find a letter waiting for them at the hotel saying that funds had been advanced, several thousand dollars, and they'd been wired in Breslin's name to the telegraph office. But when Breslin got to the telegraph office, the clerk said, "I'm not going to release these funds to you. I don't know who you are. Like, you're not a local." So they, through Talbot, they got Judge M. Cooney, who was a member of the Californian Supreme Court, and a local official of Clan na Gael, to come down to the office with Breslin, and the clerk promptly released the funds to him.
Ways and means.
They're armed. So,
So he has to get on the boat, probably
yep, so they
about
book.
time to leave.
So Breslin books two passages on the Cyphrenes, which is a speedy mail steamer bound for Sydney. And he converts his dollars into gold, which is the wealthy speculator's calling card of the day. And Breslin and Desmond arrive separately at the dock. Breslin walks up one gangplank into the first-class cabin, wearing his expensive suit and his brimmed hat, and displaying his gold pocket watch and chain. And he carried two letters with him. One was from Judge Cooney, who confirming that Mr. James Collins was a wealthy owner of vast tracts of land and silver mines in Nevada and other states. And then the second letter was a fictitious bank draft, which advised that $100,000 had been deposited as credit into his bank, and saying that the other investors in the syndicate gave him sole judgment about whether he would or wouldn't invest in Australia.
Well, it's amazing. I'm thinking that Paul Newman and Robert Redford would be two people in their day to play the parts
Exactly.
of
So
Collins, as
here,
you call him. And yeah, but what about this?
so Breslin up in the first class, and very ordinary looking passenger makes his way carrying his plain suitcase and in his plain clothing to the second class cabin downstairs, and that's Desmond. And so John.
Wonder what their accents were like.
Well,
Was
I've often wondered about that. So we know that Breslin was a great student of languages. So
Yeah.
I imagine that he would have been able to put on the Boston accent or the New York accent very carefully. And Desmond would have, he'd been in the US, in California for some time, even though he was Irish born and you know, would have been a 20-year-old man when he left Ireland. But clearly he could have posed as an Irishman, that would have, as a carriage builder, but Breslin clearly kept the American accent up
So they
the whole time.
would have sort of devised some sort of Irish class difference between the two of them, one imagines, to just make their different roles quite separate, distinguishable. So is this where we're at as we come to the end of episode four? Breslin and Desmond, J.J. Breslin, Thomas Desmond, heading for Australia, first
Yes,
Sydney.
as Mr. Collins and they're two different aliases.
It's just phenomenal, and everyone's got their fingers crossed.
They
Margot,
have indeed.
we're going to have to return soon.
Well, we've got two ships at sea now, haven't we?
We have got two ships that said we've got one out in the Atlantic and one in the Pacific. Makes you
So I
realize
think
the world's round.
in the next chapter, we'll perhaps look at what was happening on the Catalpa.
Okay, folks. Yeah, put on your. Not sure what you put on. You can't put on your seatbelts. We're not in a plane, but make sure you've got good footing, good footwear. We're going to be on the Catalpa.
Correct. On
See
the
you then
high seas.
on the high seas. See you then, Margot.
Thank you, Michael.